Okay. All right. Well, welcome everybody to the session on an economic model to evaluate extreme events for lenders, mortgage insurers, being presented by Elaine Collins and Angela Tong. Elaine joined Deloitte as a partner 4 years ago, having previously worked for KPMG Actuaries for 5 years. She has 20 years' experience in providing and leading a wide variety of general insurance advice. Elaine has continually held the appointed actuary position for a number of authorised insurers since 2001. She also acts as reviewing actuary for several insurers and reinsurers. Elaine is a current member of the Professional Standards Committee of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia. She has had particular involvement in the drafting of professional standards applicable to general insurance and their consistency to APRA reforms. Elaine has written a number of actuarial papers for insurance seminars and institute seminars. Angela Tong joined the Deloitte's Actuaries and Consultants General Insurance Practice in 2009 as a graduate analyst. During her time at Deloitte's, Angela has worked on projects including reviews of different self-insurance options, development of economic stochastic models for general insurance liability valuation, and audit reviews of general insurers. Now, I just want to remind you, before we start the meeting, remind you at the end, please complete the... What's the form? It's an it's a presenter feedback form. Oh, no, that's mine. That's his. No, it's not. No, it's a presenter feedback form. And place it in one of the barrels provided around the Hilton, and not to fold it. In other words, just slip it in the slot. Is that right? Yeah, that's it. Okay, so now sessions will be recorded, so if anybody wanted to speak comes up to the microphone and before they start spouting on what they think is good stuff, to announce who they are. Thank you. Over to you, Elaine. And Angela, I want you to work out your order.
Thank you very much, Jeff. And hello, everybody. Angela and I are planning to present for around 40 minutes, so that we leave sort of 15 or 20 minutes at the end for questions. To give you an outline, I will be introducing our topic, and then I'll hand over to Angela for all the difficult stuff in the middle. And then I'm going to conclude with some implications for risk appetite statements. We are particularly looking at an economic model to evaluate extreme events for lenders' mortgage insurance, and that's a class of general insurance business. But because it's an economic model, it's really got more general application. But the reason we formulated an economic model to look at the extreme events in this line of business is because the economic environment hugely influences the performance of LMI. Now, this is the left-hand mouse. There are proposed changes to regulatory capital, and that's sort of where we're starting, because APRA is reviewing and updating its capital standards for really two reasons. One is to really have a better risk sensitivity to the actions of the insurer, but also to achieve better alignment across the different industries that APRA regulates. There's also intended to be alignment with Solvency II. APRA has proposed the introduction of a three-pillar supervisory approach for general insurers and life insurers, and that's really intended to be similar to what's in place for banks. Pillar one is the quantitative requirements, and that's in relation to required capital, eligible capital, and a very important part of that is the liability valuation. Pillar two is the supervisory review process, and this includes the supervision of the practices of the insurer's risk management and capital management, and may include a supervisory adjustment, which is called APRA's Individual Capital Adequacy Assessment Process, ICAP. Because what keeps happening to me is I see these things ICAP, and then I always forget what it actually stands for. So I think APRA tends to call everything by the summarised form, and in the end it's actually hard to remember what it is. So this is actually APRA's capital adjustment process. And I know I have a number of actuaries have thought about this, and the question has been asked of APRA if this number is ever negative for a company that really has fantastic risk management processes. But apparently it's not intended to be negative. It's either going to be zero or it's going to be a positive number to increase the capital requirement. The third pillar is market disclosure requirements, and that's really the requirements designed to encourage market discipline. The new term, prudential capital requirement, PCR, is the total of Pillar 1 and Pillar 2. And the level of capital required for both general life insurers under the proposals is intended to correspond to a 99.5% probability of sufficiency over a one-year period. However, at the end of that period, the insurer needs to have enough money in the kitty to actually meet its obligations to policyholders, which then may extend over many years. So really the two tale of two capitals, if you like, a regulatory capital and economic capital. I know there's intended to be better alignment between those two going forward. There's a formal process for determining capital needs, reflecting an insurer's specific risk profile. And APRA's sort of spoken a lot recently about the internal capital target needs to be set by the board, and it should be based on tail events for the insurer, as well as consideration of APRA's ICAP. APRA's intervention will commence when an insurer's regulatory capital approaches its target capital, which leads one to think that if target capital is only a very tiny amount above the APRA's PCR, this will give APRA very little opportunity to intervene. But APRA have responded to that question by saying that this course of action will be discouraged. So even though the board is setting target capital, it's certainly going to be subject to review by APRA. Much discussion has been generated around various ways of looking at tail events for capital setting purposes. Aside from regulatory capital, tail events also need to be considered for an insurer's various risks when determining a company's economic capital. And then linking to solvency too, in Seamus Creedon's presentation yesterday, he mentioned that there should be alignment between the three models. And he mentioned the model for technical provisions, which is then the liability evaluation. The second model is testing of the provisions, really sort of the edge of plausibility, and the third is the capital target. And he was advocating there needs to be some linkage between those three models. And our presentation is really looking at that second one, which is the testing of the liability valuation at the extreme levels. So in this presentation, we're particularly looking at tail events for the lender's mortgage insurance, the liability. We note that for runoff insurers, APRA will look particularly at the insurance liability and will not allow capital to be reduced below the insurance liability at a 99.5% level of sufficiency. So that's a particular requirement for runoff insurers wanting to reduce their capital. However, it is useful to look at the insurance liability at various levels of sufficiency, and this is what our model will allow. So I will now hand over to Angelo, who will explain how we went about creating this.
Okay, hi everyone. So I guess as Elaine discussed, for you to actually measure what your capital needs are, you'll have to look at your tail events. So we're going to start off by looking at the different sorts of methods of measuring the tail and the pros and cons associated with each one. Then we'll move on to looking at our model, which is looking specifically at how to measure the tail for LMI insurers. And then I'll pass back to Elaine to talk about the risk appetite implications that our model has. So, first part, measuring the tail. Now, with a lot of the different methods of measuring the tail, what we're ultimately trying to do is to estimate that insurance liability distribution. There are lots of ways of doing it, and you can kind of categorize it according to how well they reflect the risk profile of your portfolio. So at one end, you've got like a really simple approach, which is just assuming a statistical distribution and then fitting that to your mean and the standard deviation of your data. And usually the log normal distribution is assumed because that's the most easy to fit. So the good thing about this sort of approach is that it's simple and it's quick to do. The problem with it, though, is that the tail of the distribution that you assume is often going to be too light. And the reason for that is because that distribution usually doesn't have a lot of relation with the underlying risk of the portfolio. So on the other side of the risk spectrum, you've got the stochastic full internal model. So what this is trying to do is they're trying to reflect all different sources of risk. So you've got claim experience, pricing, and investments. And because it is a better reflection of the underlying risk profile compared to the APRA prescribed approach, there is the potential for insurers to reduce the capital requirement. However, this sort of model is very, very time consuming to build, and it costs a lot. So, you know, that's one of the deterrents for people using that sort of model. And also for a non-technical user such as, you know, your CEO and the board members, it's quite hard for them to see how the assumptions feed into the model and spit out the results. The other thing is also for smaller players, the reduction in capital for them is not enough to offset the large amount of cost and time they're going to spend in developing these sorts of models. So at the moment, internal model isn't very widely used amongst Australian insurers. Now, if we now look to looking at the methods for measuring the tail for LMI insurers, to give you a bit of background, LMI insurance is basically insurance that protects the lender in the event that the borrower default on their loan, and if the sales proceeds from the property is not enough to cover for the outstanding loan amount. And it actually makes quite a lot of sense to use a stochastic approach when you're modelling the tail for LMI. And the reason for that is because the claim payments for LMI is very, very dependent on the economic environment. So, for example, if interest rates were going up, then your repayment is going to go up. And that will put pressure on some of your borrowers and therefore increase their probability of defaulting. And because you're looking at economic variables, there's a large amount of publicly available data for you to develop your model. And the third reason, which is probably the most important in the context of modelling extreme events, is that in an economic environment, in the economy, when something goes bad, the correlations for your economic variables tend to go to one, so everything will kind of go bad at the same time. So when you're looking at LMI, you really can't just fit a log normal to the data. You really have to look at the interactions between all the different economic variables to see what the extreme tail should be. And that's something that you can do through a stochastic approach. So based on these observations that we've made, we've constructed a model that tries to be a better reflection of the underlying risk profile. But at the same time, we want it to be something that's quite clear and transparent for a non-technical user, and also that something that can be communicated quite easily as well. So if we now look to how we constructed this model, we've got five steps in this process, and the first one probably the most important out of the five. The first one is to build an economic model, and this is probably the most fundamental part of this whole procedure, because you're basically forming a view of what the future economic environment is going to be. So if you don't do this right, then everything else is going to fall apart. And then in the second step, you determine how your portfolio is going to respond to these economic scenarios. So once you've got those two things done, then you can just simulate your scenarios and then plot your empirical distribution. And then lastly, I'll just wrap up with some other considerations that we had to look at throughout this modelling process as well. So let's have a look at each of them in a bit more detail now. Okay, so the economic model. All right, you might remember that a couple of slides ago, I talked about how claim payments for LMI is very dependent on the economic environment. We can break the claim payments for LMI further down into two of the key components. So that would be the first being the chance of you defaulting, and the second being the claim amount if the default actually does happen. Now, if we look at the probability of default, that's going to be driven by interest rate, inflation, and unemployment rate. So for example, as I said before, if interest rate goes up, then your repayment's going to go up, the borrower's going to be under a lot of under pressure, and then they'll default on their loans. Interest rate is going to work in a similar way to, inflation is going to work in a similar way to interest rate. For unemployment, if unemployment were to go up, then there's a higher chance that the borrower will be out of a job. And again, that's going to increase their probability of default. Now, for the second component, for claim amount if a default does happen, that's mainly going to be driven by house price index. So if you think about it, if the house price housing market is going down, then when you sell your house, if the policy defaults, the sales proceeds from that from the property is probably not going to be as likely to cover for the outstanding loan amount of the policy. So far, I've kind of talked about these two different components as if they were in isolation. But the thing is, house price index is also driven by the three economic variables that impact probability of default. So indirectly, interest rate, inflation, and unemployment is going to drive the claim amount given default as well. So we really need to look at the interaction between these four variables to see how they impact probability of default and claim amount given default. And that's the motivation for us building an economic model. So we use regression analysis to build a multivariate time series model. And it's multivariate because we need to incorporate interest rates, inflation, unemployment, and house price index. Now, for house price index, what we've projected in here is the national house price index. But you're going to see some states where house prices are going up and other states where it's going down. So to allow for that difference, we've made some adjustments to it. For example, New South Wales might be going up, whereas WA might be going up, and then like Tasmania might be going down or something. So the model structure that we end up with is pretty much what I've just been talking about before. Those variables you see in the yellow boxes, that's going to affect probability of default, but they're also going to feed into house price index, which in turn drives the claim amount given default. So that sort of model structure ensures that there is a correlation between these four variables. We've also tried to build a model that's consistent with academic research. So here are some of the key features that we've incorporated in there. First of all, momentum. That's basically the tendency of an economic model to keep moving in the same direction. And the way we've incorporated that is using autocorrelation terms, which is, you know, basically the correlation of an economic variable to its past historical values. We've also tried to incorporate mean reversion, which is the tendency of an economic variable to revert back to its long-term mean the further it moves away from that mean. And as we talked about in the previous slide, there were the correlations between the economic variables. Now, with the correlation, sometimes it's going to be lagged. So, for example, house price is affected by unemployment, but it might not be affected by unemployment in the same period. It's probably going to be affected by unemployment three periods back or something. So we've had that. We've incorporated that in our model. One of the key things that I want to emphasize about this economic model is that it was a very iterative process. So when we were building it, we had to test removing and adding different variables in the regression model to make sure that that our projection actually looks like historical data, and also allow for extreme events occurring. The reason for that is because we're building this model to look at extreme tail events. So we really do need to have some of those massive drops in house prices to give us a fat enough tail in the resulting empirical distribution. Okay, so just to show you some of the results from our modelling, this is like the sample path for the economic variables. For this one that we have here, it's the interest rate, and that red dotted line is like the valuation date of where we are at the moment. So you can see for interest rate, pretty much, the trend is similar to what you see historically. And you'll notice that there's two distinct scenarios as well in the past, and that's because of the RBA's change in their regime. For our model, we've based it on that second regime because we think that's going to go forward, but, you know, it's pretty much just based on what your view of the future is like. What we have here is inflation. And again, you see the same sort of jaggedness in the sample path as you see in the historical data. Same thing for unemployment. And then finally, we have house price index. Now, this one's quite interesting, because if you think about it, when you're using a time series to do your projections, you're assuming that the future environment is going to be the same as your historical environment. So any feature that you don't see in the past, it's generally you're not going to see in your projections. Because we're sort of building this model for extreme tail events, we do need those big drops in house prices. The problem with that is we haven't seen any of those big drops in house prices in the past. So it's quite important to note that for our modelling process, we actually made a few adjustments rather than using the straight statistical time series model. And we think this is appropriate because, you know, when you build this model, you're basically building a view of the future. And if you don't think that future is going to be similar to the past, then, you know, it's fine to make some adjustments to allow for that. So that's just putting all four of them on the same graph. So that's one simulation. Another simulation, this is just to show that, you know, we do see some of those big drops in house prices to give us those extreme events. So that brings me to the end of step one, which is building an economic model. And as a recap as to why we need to build an economic model, we said that the probability of default is driven by interest rate, inflation, and unemployment. And the claim amount given default by the house price index, but also indirectly by the other three economic variables. So in the second step of our modelling procedure, we're going to look at exactly how those economic scenarios is going to translate to the probability of default and the claim amount given default for a particular policy. So first up, let's look at what's going to cause a policy to default. In our model, we've assumed that a policy will only default if the borrower loses their job or if the mortgage rates goes up too high. So for mortgage rate-induced defaults, it's quite obvious to see how it's related directly to the economic scenario because the mortgage rate is just simply equal to the interest rate plus the net interest margin. And we've also allowed for some differences in riskiness between the policies. So, for example, a standard variable policy is going to be obviously is going to have a lower risk than your low-doc policy. And similarly, for a policy that has a loan-to-value ratio of greater than 90%, they're going to be the riskier ones as well because they were the ones that didn't have enough money to buy the house in the first place. For unemployment-related defaults, again, it's quite obvious how it's related to the economic scenario because if you have high unemployment, then there's going to be a greater number of borrowers in your portfolio who are going to be out of a job. But the other thing that you need to think about is the probability of them finding a job. Like, you know, once they become unemployed, what's their probability of finding a job in the next month or so? The other thing is, when someone becomes unemployed, they're not going to default immediately on the loan. So you also have to think about how long do they become unemployed before they default. Okay, so now let's have a look at the loss given default. So house price index will govern the movement of a property, but you've also got to make an assumption around the sales price fluctuation around the state HPR if and when that property is sold in the event of a default. Also, interest rate has a pretty direct relationship to loss given default because if mortgage rates were to go up, then the outstanding balance of the loan will also go up. So if the loan does default, then the sales of the property might not be sufficient to cover the higher outstanding balance. And then just a few other assumptions that we had in our model: expense rates related to the sales, discount rate to get your discount cash flow, and then obviously the valuation date as well. So once you've got those two, the first two steps sorted out, then you can just run, you know, heaps of economic scenarios and look at how your portfolio is going to respond under each scenario. So, for example, you do one simulation and you get a projection of interest rate, inflation, unemployment and state HPI over a period of, say, 30 years. And then based on the rules that you set in step two, you look at how your policy is going to respond and whether it's going to give rise to a claim or not. And some policy is going to, you know, lead to a claim and some are not. Then what you do is you sum up all the cash flows across all the policies in your portfolio to get your liability. And this process is repeated many times to give you a distribution of the results. Now, I know that this model is constructed in an Excel environment and it's run using a macro. But even with that, we were able to run several thousand simulations. So it's pretty sophisticated in that respect. And really, because you are looking at the extreme tail, you do need to have a large number of simulations before you can have robust results. So if you plot the empirical distribution based on your simulation results, then you should get a very right-skewed distribution. And pretty much then you can just read off whatever percentile you want. So for example, as Elaine mentioned, for a runoff insurer, APRA requires them to hold insurance liability at the 99.5th percentile. So what you do is you rank your all your observations and then just read off the 99.5th biggest observation. But apart from that, if you think back to what Elaine talked about earlier on ICAP, the insurer can determine in conjunction with APRA at what percentile they want to hold their liability at. And having this sort of distribution will make it quite easy for them to look at what exactly the insurance liability value would be. Okay, so just to wrap up, I'm going to talk about some of the other considerations that we had when going through the modelling process. So firstly, insurers are usually not just interested in the capital requirements as at the valuation date. They're going to want to know what it is after year one, after year two, and so on. So if we just concentrate on liability related to... Sorry, well, if we just look at the liability part of capital, this model actually gives you quite a simple approach to do that. Because... we've got the discounted cash flow for each year, right? So that means if they want to look at the, if they want to find out what the insurance liability is after 1 year, then they would just sum up all the cash flows from year one to the end of their projection period. If they want their insurance liability at the end of year two, they would sum up the cash flows from year two to the end of their projection period. So it's quite easy. Another consideration is the impact of future policy discontinuances. And this is quite important for runoff insurers. Now, when policies discontinue, you're going to end up with a smaller portfolio and therefore a reduced exposure. But what happens if the policies that discontinue are the ones that have a lower risk and you end up with anti-selection against the insurer? So you kind of have to balance out that these two forces to determine whether there is a material impact from discontinuances on your insurance liability. And finally, for life insurers, you also have to consider that, but also you need to look at new business growth as well. And with that in mind, I'll pass back to Elaine to talk about the next thing on the agenda.
Thank you, Angela. I have a few comments on implications for risk appetite because, as you can see, we're really talking about the many of the insurance liability, looking at the tail and seeing the implications for capital around that. But the risk appetite statement, after hearing what Ian Lachlan has to say about risk appetite, it's a far longer and more complex document than I originally had in mind. I thought it was something more around stating the board's appetite for risk, but it really needs to contain a number of pieces of information in it. For example, it needs to contain scenario and stress testing, assessing tail percentiles, as well as providing effective communication. So the outputs from an insurer's model to simulate insurance liability at various levels of efficiency would need to form part of that risk appetite statement. So we think that a model such as the one we described, actually I meant to mention too that we created this model in Excel, but it could well be created in some other form, like in SAS or something like that too, doing a similar thing, but then you could do more simulations and it would be easier to do that. But we really wanted to just kind of take the middle ground of a model that simulated outcomes but was not too complex. In particular, the communication part of the insurer's risk appetite statement needs to show reporting on the risks to which the entity is exposed, and also needs to show scenario and stress testing results, how they were performed and reported to the board. And our model would show how the insurance liability results at various tail percentiles assisted in determining what the insurer's capital would be. We also note that the governance and implementation parts of the insurer's risk appetite statement would need to show review of the current economic conditions, and that's something that's very relevant, and also understanding of the risk tolerances. And another part of the risk appetite statement needs to cover risk management. And where this would assist is it would show the material types of risks, because it also needs to show clear boundaries and supported by limits, of which insurance risks are a key aspect for the insurer. So in conclusion, we believe that an economic model such as ours can be useful for a number of purposes, and we look forward to the discussion. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Elaine and Angela. Certainly a good mix of interesting issues there, I would have thought. And the floor is now open for input.
Daniel Levy, thanks. Looks like a fascinating piece of work. You talked about at the start the log normal distribution not having fat enough tails. Did you do a comparison of the outcomes with your model here to on how fatter the tails ended up?
That's a very good question. I'll hand over to Angela.
I'll try to answer part of it. We started doing the modelling at first using a log normal. And obviously that was quite similar and quite quick to do. But, and then we did this whole modelling thing because we thought the log normal just isn't appropriate enough. Not because we thought the tail was too light, but because of what we know generally. And then comparing the final result to what we got in the log normal, we do see that it's a much, higher liability compared to what was in the log normal one.
And it also sounded like some of the surprises that we see in the real world that we never model are probably not modelled here. And have you thought about how you'd talk about that to the board? Even a pandemic and the impact on household incomes and, other maybe less extreme scenarios as well.
Yes, I guess that's around the whole communication side, because as Angela was saying earlier, we had to actually make sure that extreme events that weren't necessarily in our history were actually captured in the tails. We had to make specific allowance and had a look at some of the sample parts to make sure that we did get some extreme events happening. And then once you've done that, then the second part is the communication to the board and explaining how these can happen and they're in the tail. And yes, we've tried to do that in the best way we can.
Bob Conger with the Casualty Actuarial Society. Very interesting presentation, and it sounds like the construction of the model was probably really quite an interesting process for you folks who had the chance to do that. A couple of questions for you. You referred to extreme events, and in the context of the at least the dimensions of the model that you illustrated, you were really thinking of extreme economic events, but I'm wondering about other kinds of extreme events. For example, if there were a extreme flooding in one sector of the country, that might have quite a dramatic impact on housing prices and on abandonments of houses and so forth. But I also wondered whether, as you were using this model, and this was really triggered by your comment about the change in perhaps the interest rate environment caused by policy decisions made on some broader political plane, whether you tried using this model to test the effects of other kinds of perhaps policy decisions. For example, how different would your results be if the interest rate regime changed? What would happen if, for an ongoing company, if some feature of the insurance itself, perhaps coinsurance or deductible, something like that, were changed? How much does that alter the results that you get? And also, whether the introduction of the insurance or the availability of the insurance or changes in the nature of the insurance creates a change in the triggering behaviors. For example, in the U.S., we saw that as mortgage holders were able to shed their risks to other people, that changed their behavior, their risk appetite at the front end to take on risky mortgages. If somebody else is going to carry the ultimate risk, then you really have a different initialization process and a different risk profile. And whether you did any testing of that sort, not perhaps stochastically, but by introducing different structures through the model.
Thank you, Bob. I thought I might answer the flat question and ask Angela to answer the interrate question. But just a commentary on the nature of the portfolio. Bob, we did look at a portfolio that existed now and the behaviour of that portfolio rather than looking at if criteria change going forward, what kind of a different portfolio we would have. But just to answer your flood question, of course, it's so relevant because we had, you know, huge flooding in Queensland in January and a number of us had to value lenders' mortgage insurance portfolios at 31 December, taking into account events that might have happened beyond the valuation date, but before the actual report was signed. And certainly we did look at that, and it is a good consideration. But then again, I guess just to clarify, we did really just, it was an economic model, and that was the factors that we looked at. But then when something like that happened, we saw, will that have an effect on some of the economic variables? For example, unemployment rates. You know, will it mean that more people are unemployed now because of the huge flooding that occurred? Some businesses had to shut down. You know, how long would that occur for and so on? And when we did look at it, we did, so we now appointed actuary work at the end of the year, we did look at the impact and made some allowance for the fact that, you know, it would take longer to sell houses, people could be unemployed for a period, there could potentially be stress to those policyholders. But in our extreme economic model, the model that we're looking at now for the extreme events was more around if those events do happen, what's the effect on unemployment and interest rates? And we thought that was sort of captured in past data. So.
So in relation to the interest rate question that you had, we actually did think about, you know, using a multi-state sort of model where it would change if the RBA does decide to change the regime again. But we thought it was a bit too complicated for something that was going to be built in Excel. And also because, you know, there are all sorts of different things that you can model, but we want to kind of distill the key things that was relevant for, well, that's immediately relevant, I guess. And, you know, if things does change in the future, then we might have to build, like, refresh our model again.
Yes, and certainly I wasn't meaning to suggest that it would have been meaningful to your model to build in sort of a stochastic probability of a regime change affecting interest rates, but so it would be more of a scenario test, I suppose.
Yeah.
Here's how our interest rates would behave under the current regime. Here's how they might behave under some hypothesized alternative regime. Also, just as a parting question, you commented on the internal models that the internal model might produce a conclusion of lower capital needed. And perhaps I don't have enough knowledge of the specific ways that internal models are constructed, but my experience has also been frequently that a well-informed model often leads to you realizing that your risks out in the tail are larger. So I've seen certainly plenty of chances for a model to produce larger capital requirements than a naive formulaic approach.
Yeah.
That is absolutely true that some of the internal models produced high capital requirements compared to APRA's standard model, which was particular factors applied to particular risks.
So. Yeah. The thing with that is, like, we're not anticipating everyone who uses an internal model to have a lower capital requirement. And, you know, as you were saying at the beginning, it's most likely that because they're becoming, they realize that there are other risks that they didn't model before, that their capital requirement will increase. But through this modeling process, they're going to have a better understanding of their risks. And over time, and also they'll show APRA that they'll have a better understanding of those risks. And so over time, with that better understanding, there'll be better risk management. And having that framework in place will have a greater chance of them lowering their capital requirements over time because they have better management.
Hi, Tony Byrne. Enjoyed your presentation. I was just wondering, you talked a lot about the process of going through. I was wondering if you could speak at all about the results on if things were, you know, more or less volatile than you expected them to be, or, you know, just kind of where things wound up from your modeling approach.
Can you clarify what you mean by things are more volatile than what we expected?
Well, you talked a lot about the process of how you built the model and you know, reference to capital standards. I was wondering about the results of your modeling and if, having built the model and looked at the results that came out of it, you've had any insights that you found or change in perspective or anything like that.
So were the results as we expected?
Yeah. That's more specific.
No.
Than No, the results weren't as we expected, and then we would always go back to see what are the actual implications. That's where you look more carefully at the sample paths to make sure that we really were capturing extreme events as we thought was reasonable. So it is a very interactive process, and I can totally understand how black box models can just produce results that seem outrageous because there's a whole lot of dependencies in there, and even though you're trying to mimic historic experience and then perhaps look at more extremes that might have happened historically, it is still subject to, you know, some very strange behaviour. And you do have to look at it carefully and make sure that you're getting something, you're putting something in, you're modelling it, that really you are getting something that seems sensible in the outcome. So we did have some figures to compare to because we had done valuations at central estimate level and 75% level, so we kind of had some calibration in mind. And I do think you need that. There always needs to be a checkpoint rather than just say, this number came out, so therefore it must be right.
It sounds like climate change modelling, doesn't it?
Oh, no.
Hi, Nolene Wolf here. Thank you for the presentation. It was really interesting. But I suppose the presentation focused quite a lot on coming up with the tail distribution of the insurance liabilities, and I suppose I'm just wondering, obviously all of these economic assumptions also influence the value of the assets. And you did make a comment about correlations at extreme levels. Now APRA's obviously put out there some correlation factors that they're going to use in the minimum capital requirement, and so I suppose I'm just looking for some feedback or commentary on the interrelationship between assets and insurance liabilities for lenders, mortgage insurers, and whether you looked at the assets side as well, or whether it was really just more focused on the liabilities.
Yeah, no, we did focus on the liabilities, and we obtained obviously our own figures around correlations and so on of those economic variables, and we haven't actually compared our correlations to APRA's correlations, so that would be a step that needs to be undertaken.
Yes.
Well, I got it. It's Brent Walker, and I loved it. I came here because I wanted to see how you could fatten the tails. And I think you've probably taught me a little bit about that, but I'm also interested in how you wag the tail. Now, actually, I'm serious about that because in the field that I work in, I talk about the tail not only being fat but wagging a bit. You know, it's got wobbles in it, and so you can get periods. You know, this extreme volatility. You know, it's like black swan lumps in the tail, if you like, if you could think of it that way. But I've got some funny questions anyway. Does your model allow for the very great differences in the property markets within states? You know, because we've noticed, you know, something quite peculiar has happened since the GFC. Parts of New South Wales or parts of the Sydney market have recovered completely, and yet other parts have, you know, they're still sitting at, say, 70% of what they were pre-GFC values. Mm. And so I've got four questions.
Oh.
So if you can remember them.
Answer one at a time, though.
Is there a difference? But do you allow for the? Oh, okay. Well, one at a time. Then what's that one?
The differences. The straight answer is yes, we did. So we applied factors.
Yeah.
That was kind of. It's not just a straight factor that we apply. Yeah. So that factor is also a stochastic factor as well.
Okay. Does the model allow for differences between interest only and reducing capital balance loans? The very risky loans are the ones that that people borrow and they only pay interest only on. You know, they get 95% or something. Rather than
we differentiated by LVR band, but not whether it was interest only or interest on capital.
Okay, because I think that's going to be an important issue.
Yeah.
Yeah. That led me to the next question. Is there any difference between the term of the risk, the term of the loan? Because obviously if it's a reducing capital value loan, then the longer the term, the less risk the insurer's got.
Well, the interesting part is that there's such a high turnover of loans. Very few loans actually do go to the 25 years. After about 3 or 4 years, they get refinanced. So
I'm a baby boomer. I keep my loans forever. my final one, I've got two more, actually. Have you ever thought of modelling something like what's happened in Christchurch, where 10 or 20%, I think it's about 20% of the houses in Christchurch have to be written off, through an earthquake? And, what would happen then? That's just an interesting thought.
It's a very good question.
That's an extreme event.
Yeah, but that's happened. We haven't modelled that, but that would be very interesting,
Yeah. And the last one really is... do you have any further insights on how you can fatten the tails?
I probably can't give you an answer straight off the top of my head.
I'm fascinated in what you've done, that's all.
Well, we pretty much presented most of what we did in that presentation because we try to give you as much detail around what we did as possible.
Yeah. But have you thought, in the process of going through this, this will make the tail fatter or...
Not really. We were mainly looking at the results we obtained and trying to get what we thought was a reasonable set of results, and we felt like the tail in the end was the right shape for this. So we don't have a magic answer on how to fatten tails, no.
Alina from Sidhu. Got a question about housing prices. I understand in the US, when a lot of the assets were valued, they thought the prices would always go up indefinitely. Just wondering, what's your view of an extreme event in the Australian market around housing prices?
I guess the problem with that is we haven't seen an extreme event with housing prices. Do you want to?
Yep. So we really modelled as per past experience with the variability between housing prices, and bear in mind that variability factor that we took into account, as Angela said, it was a stochastic modelling around housing prices. I mean, some houses drop by 30% when other houses raise by 2%. So, there are the extremes that you're talking about for a proportion of houses, but it wasn't quite the same percentage of houses that it affected the US. I mean, in the US, there was a significant proportion of houses having a 30% drop, whereas the past history we've seen in Australia, there have been those drops, but they've been to a smaller proportion of the houses, and that's really the modelling that we've taken into account.
So if the bubble bursts, might potentially have, I guess, a systemic...
You could potentially, but there's a lot of other factors at stake there. For example, in the US, there's different requirements around people being able to walk away from houses and never pay the loan off, whereas in Australia, you carry that problem with you. You can't just leave it behind. So there's different regulation around that. And also there was when those loans were being raised, the person organising the financing could walk away from the risk completely, and they weren't on risk. There was no risk retained for that person at all. That's changed too now. So there was a whole lot of factors in place that actually led to that huge downturn. And if those factors aren't there, well, you'll get a different outcome. But of course, the problem always is that the next big problem is something you actually can't foresee yet. And you really need to just try and do your best around what has happened and then try to think what could happen.
And just to add to what Elaine said about not being able to foresee what an extreme event is, I mean, you really can't say, oh, you know, if we see in our sample path something goes down really, like, a lot, we can't say, oh, that's not possible. But what we can say is, you know, what are some of the really not, like, really, really tail events, which, like, I mean, if it drops all the way to zero, that's not possible. So what we did in our modelling procedure was we set some floors to house price and some ceilings as well. So it can't go too high. That means it's got to bounce back, you know, so that, you know, we're not allowing for too many bubbles to happen or for bubbles to continue on for too long. So I think with those sort of mechanisms in place, we've allowed for some of that, you know, to make sure that those extreme events does happen.
But it's interesting that the model could go too extreme if we didn't put some of these things in place to actually stop it becoming totally unbelievable.
So it wouldn't work for a mortgage insurer in Sendai?
Perhaps not.
It might exclude earthquake. Anyone else?
Yep. Martin Hitwin. Just most general insurance classes, the risks are relatively independent, mm-hmm. but with lenders' mortgage insurance, because it's effectively credit risk, mm-hmm. As you say, it's very economic exposure, it's mm-hmm. very correlated between risks. So just a comment, if you actually think it should be an insurance class, mm-hmm. given that high correlation and sort of a credit risk component for it. And just the second one, in terms of the modelling, in terms of the starting point for house prices, we had Anthony Street's session yesterday where he made a reasonably compelling case that property prices were quite high. Do you have a starting point for where property prices are, or do you effectively assume they're fairly valued at the starting point, or do you have in there an assumption that, for example, looking at rental yields or some sort of valuation of where property prices are at the current time?
That's a good question. We didn't really consider the validity of what property prices are now. We started where we are now, and then we moved from then on. But we felt like we allowed sufficient downturns to occur so that if they were overvalued right now, that was incorporated in our answers. And then just to answer your question around other insurance classes of business, we felt that CCI, consumer credit, was probably, you'd do something reasonably similar because it's also very linked towards the economic environment, consumer credit insurance, whereas other insurance like motor vehicle and householders and so on, that's really quite different, and the sort of events that lead to extreme outcomes in those classes are quite different. So I guess you'd use the principles of our model, but you would apply it in a somewhat different way. And the factors, of course, would be different and your correlations would be different.
Now, we're just about at the end now. I just want to make sure that there's nobody else who's got a desperate need to say something. No, okay. In that case, we might wrap up. check my notes. That's what I must do as chairman of the stage. Perhaps the first thing, though, is to make a comment of my own, which is just simply that I was fascinated by the whole presentation, and the model that's been developed seems to be pretty well cover all the things that are 90% of the things that are necessary to meet any board's queries. I'm sure there will always be one or little tweaks you can do. In particular, I think the fattening of the tail and how that was done, which you haven't really disclosed very well, I don't think. and particularly this question of extreme events. Now, I thought back in 1989-90 or whereabouts. Certainly the area I was living, house prices fell by about 20%. I consider that to be an extreme event. But, of course, it was only... it wasn't necessarily only where I was living, but it certainly wasn't... You know, where I was living wasn't necessarily the only part where... there were variances throughout Sydney, Melbourne and Adelaide and so on. The other point that I would suggest that you might consider is this question of where the starting point... if you ever read The Economist, they come out every time and saying of all the countries in the whole world and the universe, our prices are more overvalued than anybody else's are. They have got a methodology for producing that, which is based on average rental yields, which one would have thought has some merit, although, of course, it's not the be-all and end-all. But it may be worthwhile reflecting that at the present time, the market also is noting that the number of new mortgages is dying. The banks are fighting with each other to try and grab existing business rather than new business. All of this suggests that perhaps we're at least got on a bit of a plateau as far as house prices are concerned, if not necessarily expecting a fall. Just a point from, you know, somebody, you know, the man in the street, if you like. So anyway, with that said in mind, I'd like to congratulate the authors on a wonderful presentation, and just hope that other people would feel the same way and give the usual acclamation.